But the way I wrote about a set of technological innovations was very much of a piece with how we talked about the role that the internet was playing in politics. And that was a largely optimistic story about how social media in particular was allowing more people to become involved in the political process. And that was, you know, a big part of the way we talked about Obama's victory in 2008, but it was also part of the global narrative about technology and campaigns. As I was finishing that book, the Arab Spring was beginning, and the origin myth that everybody was sort of happy to accept was that, you know, one guy in Cairo who had a Twitter account, but he did not control a state broadcasting organ, he didn't have a political party, could tweet, you know, come meet me in Tahrir Square and start the type of social movement that previously would have taken decades to build. And the story that, you know, the Arab Spring, the Obama campaign, all of it was basically, the idea was if the internet had lowered the barriers to political participation, and we saw a lot of good, encouraging things come out of that. By the time you get to 2016, it becomes clear that you lower the barriers to political participation, and a lot of bad things can happen too. There are a whole lot of people who could get involved in American politics who were sort of kept out before because, you know, our campaign finance system and our laws and you required the amount of money to get involved in politics kept them out. And that includes, you know, foreign governments and people just trying to make money off of political communication. And that's when this language of disinformation, misinformation really became part of the political conversation. And I think that everybody has had to reckon with how do you navigate an environment where a whole lot of people can be political communicators at a large scale who are not candidates, they're not parties, they're not established interest groups, they might not even be trying to win an election, but they are able to reach large numbers of people and communicate about candidates or ideas, issues.
Do we need to make a distinction between misinformation and disinformation?
Probably not, but people do. So the way academic researchers think about it is that they tend to have three categories. Misinformation is any sort of falsehood. Disinformation is a falsehood that was created or spread with the goal of deceiving people, with the intent to deceive. And malinformation is a term that gets used sometimes to describe something that's missing necessary context to interpret it. Academic researchers use these terms for practical terms, you know, for us as journalists, for citizens, for the campaigns I write about. It doesn't really matter, I think, most of the time, whether the intent of somebody was to deceive, if it ends up circulating in a world where people could be deceived by it.
To be sure, lies and misinformation are nothing new in the world of politics and political campaigning. What's different today?
I think what's different today is that it is much easier for a lie to reach scale or scope. You know, if you go back just 20, 30 years, you know, I'm speaking at the Dole Institute today, so let's go back to 1996 just to pick a random date in the pre-internet era of American politics. If you wanted to reach a large number of people in 1996, you either needed an established media organ working for your newspaper, a magazine, a radio station. You had to have a lot of money, a significant amount of money to buy paid advertising. You needed to be an established public figure or institution who could command the attention of journalists. And you often needed to be close to the people that you were trying to reach. Your radio signal was limited in how far it could go, for example. What has happened is now you don't need any of those things to reach a large number of people. And what that has done has meant all of those factors I just mentioned in the sort of, you know, imaginary 1996 forced you as the speaker to be accountable because you had a media organization, you're a public figure, often who is regulated by the Federal Election Commission or your state laws. You had to have a physical footprint often where you were. So it was hard. There were always stories of sort of anonymous smears and word of mouth. And, you know, in the 90s, we started to hear about some people got robocalls that said this, or there were, you know, Xerox flyers under windshields, but you can never reach that many people that way if you are unaccountable. And once you are accountable, then your opposition, another candidate, another party, another news organization could hold you accountable in front of voters and citizens and say, you know, Bob Dole lied, or the Democratic Party isn't telling you the truth, and that could become part of the information that voters took into account. And politicians lived in fear of being called a liar, which is why the joke we always make is that politicians are always shading the truth and sort of being literally accurate, but not really, because it was seen as a huge reputational damage to be called a liar. News organizations did not want to be called liars. And what has happened now is some of that shame is gone, but the big issue is that you now have functionally unaccountable speakers who are able to reach a large number of people. And those can be, you know, foreign intelligence services is kind of the, you know, the one we talk about a lot, but also there are a lot of foreign individuals, groups who are just trying to make money off of advertising clicks and realize that the way to do that is to put out political content aimed at Americans, but also people in their basement who are not, you know, using their real name, or people are just trying to sort of sow chaos or have fun. And you can no longer say so-and-so is a liar and he or she should be judged by voters if they're not part of that political process. And that's a really different environment for the candidates and parties to have to navigate when you can't point back to the person who's saying something unfair about you and ask that voters judge them as well as judge you.
Sash, I want to dig into something you just alluded to, and that's that I think for many of us, we assume that most political disinformation is done for political purposes to win elections. But you argue that a lot of it isn't really driven by politics at all. It's all about money.
Yeah, we have a lot of evidence of this. It's all sort of scattered and anecdotal because nobody has a handle on the full range of this stuff. But we have enough examples of some of it is for money. Some of it is so chaos, sometimes sort of strategic chaos, which is, I think, the best theory that our intelligence services have about perhaps some of the Russian or Iranian involvement in our politics. Maybe they have a desired outcome in terms of election results, but also they see some, the best estimate is they see some strategic advantage in just creating political conflict in the United States, even if it doesn't lead to a particular election result. And I think there are also just a lot of people who have fun, have sport making stuff up online. And so I think the motives are varied, but when I wrote that book, The Victory Lab, I quoted one of my main characters comparing it to an arms race between Democrats and Republicans, each trying to get out in front of the other one on these sort of data experiment-driven innovations. But all that was predicated on the idea that both sides were trying to get to the same outcome, which was to get 50% of the vote in the same election. And they were trying to leapfrog one another in terms of the tools that they had available to do that. Almost all political strategy is predicated on the idea that your opponent is trying to do the same thing you are. And you're playing the same game. Now, if you're a campaign, you have to anticipate that your opposition isn't necessarily your opponent, and your opposition might have a totally different set of incentives and motives and objectives. They're not necessarily trying to win an election. They just want chaos. They're having fun. They want to make money. Who knows? But it becomes really hard if you are in that environment to think like a political strategist, because they're always thinking, well, if I were on the other side, what would I be doing? Well, but if you're a Macedonian teenager trying to make money off of Facebook ads, that's not the way that, you know, Kamala Harris's campaign manager thinks about what she's doing. And that's the big, that's the thing that I think really challenges the people who are running campaigns, who generally thought of themselves as sort of know-it-alls, but they had the right to think of themselves as know-it-alls because they were up against other people who were just like them. And now they're up against people who are very different than them often.
Sasha Eisenberg is the author of The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. At the heart of the lie detectives is a young woman named Jory Craig. Tell me about Jory.
Yeah, so she ends up sort of becoming the main character of this book and the central figure in the sort of counter disinformation world that the American left and center left in particular have created over the last 8 years. My book starts basically in the aftermath of the 2016 election, right? And so everybody in Democratic politics is trying to understand, everybody in American politics is shocked by Donald Trump's victory, and especially, you know, everybody in Democratic politics wants to understand how this happened. And there are lots of different roads, you know, Hillary Clinton didn't campaign enough in Wisconsin and she lost ground with white working class men, whatever. But one line of inquiry is all these things that happened on the internet over the course of 2016 that nobody fully understood as they were happening. And after Trump's victory, you have some of the major figures in the Democratic Party, donors, folks at labor unions start saying, wow, like, we've been involved in campaigns for a while, but there's this whole vocabulary that we've never had to encounter before. What are bots? What are trolls? What, you know, how do we think about how you deal with this in the context of upcoming campaigns? And they start saying, who should we be talking to about this? And it turns out nobody in Democratic politics in the United States has any experience with this either, because it's all this sort of novel intrusion into the way the world of campaigns here. And they all sort of find their way eventually to this 25-year-old woman named Jory Craig. She grew up in Illinois. She was a model UN nerd in high school. Turns out you can get you can go to college on a scholarship for model UN in some places, which was one of the big findings of my reporting for this book. And she was interested in the world and got an internship out of college at a Democratic consulting firm in Washington that, by sort of quirk of its history, had the largest overseas consulting practice. The founding partner had been Bill Clinton's pollster, but he'd also worked for Nelson Mandela and Tony Blair. So they did campaigns on basically every continent. And Jory Craig, her first assignment as a 22-year-old is she gets sent to Moldova to help a parliamentary leader go on Facebook. And she starts getting sent to do digital consulting all around the world. She's in Gabon. She's in Panama. She's in the Philippines. During the 2016 election, she's in the Bahamas helping a candidate for prime minister there, and she has never worked on a campaign in her home country. But after 2016, she's the only person in the sort of Democratic professional class who has the proper frame of reference to think about this, because all these things that seem like these novel intrusions on our politics in 2016, foreign interference, the rise of partisan ideological media, the real influence of rumor and conspiracy theory, they were new to our politics, or new to our modern politics, at least. But they're not new to politics. In large parts of the world, these things are taken for granted, right? It's totally understood in a lot of countries, you go Eastern Europe, for example, that foreign governments or business interests are going to try to shape election results because somebody could get a mining contract or, like, whatever it is. You go, you know, travel through the Middle East or North Africa, people assume that rumors are going to shape political opinion. It has been that way for decades. What she had the context to not think of this as a digital problem. So many people are inclined to think, oh, the disinformation's coming over the internet, it's an internet problem. And what she realized, you know, intuitively, I think, was that people started to make bad decisions when they thought of it as an internet problem. And she had the frame of reference she had guided candidates and party leaders who had to make decisions about political tactics in an environment with rumors and foreign interference and partisan media, and could get them to have the sort of perspective that they needed to not overreact. And she becomes the sort of the first full-time counter disinformation operative in American politics. And she ends up building a sort of structure within the left that plays a really important role in Joe Biden's campaign in 2020, and it allows different candidates and parties and organizations to share information and train their staff so that they are often not overreacting to whatever sort of bubbling up online today, which was the sort of tendency of, I think, a lot of Democratic operatives to do.
But there's a real tension, isn't there, between we don't want to overreact, but we also don't want to ignore what's happening and what people are hearing out there.
Absolutely. And this is the, you know, there was this real impulse, I think, among folks on the left in the sort of resistance era against Trump was, and you know, to do something. And I think that it shaped in part because people saw disinformation maybe as a threat to their own candidacies, but also this threat to American democracy and an educated citizenry, and also a threat possibly to our national security. And so I think there's this well-meaning impulse of, like, we see it anywhere, we need to push back. And that might be the right posture for policymakers to take, but it's definitely not the right approach if you are running a campaign. The simple fact is that if you are a public figure or institution in the United States now, people will be lying about you online all day, every day, right? This is true if you're a politician, but it's also true if you're a sports team or you're a university or you're a company or you're a celebrity. Like, it is just taken for granted. It should be taken for granted, but often it's not. And what the fact is, probably 99% of the time, you should ignore it because it is not reaching that many people, or it is not reaching the people whose opinions or behaviors you care about, right? If you're running a campaign, you care about the small share of voters in most of our elections whose opinions are up for grabs. Maybe you care about your supporters or your donors not getting demoralized. But otherwise, unless it's reaching those people in your district or your state, on an issue that will change their opinions or behavior, you should ignore it. If you're a company, unless it's going to affect your share price, you should ignore it. If you're a sports team, unless it's going to affect your season ticket sales, you should ignore it. 99% of the time, that's the right answer. Figuring out when the 1%, when it actually will be getting in front of people whose opinions you care about, that's the difficult challenge. And what Jory Craig has been a pioneer at was coming up with a sort of data collection and sharing infrastructure so that people had a sensible baseline for understanding when is this an abnormal amount of disinformation, and how do we think about the actual harm that this particular claim might have against me on the outcomes I care about. And, you know, I think often we see indicators of what people are talking about online without any context. So, oh, there's a trending topic about whatever. Well, is that a trending topic every day or not? Or, wow, this got 600 shares. Well, first of all, where are those shares? Are these people of voting age? Are they living in your state? Are they, and is 600 a lot? I don't know. And I think that we sort of intuitively, everybody, you don't have to be a political professional to intuitively understand this about the offline world, which is to say, if I told you that a couple of people at the end of the bar on Massachusetts Avenue in Lawrence were saying something nasty about you, as a public figure, you might hurt your feelings, but you'd probably say, I shouldn't give a press conference to say that those two people at the end of the bar are, why? Because you'll draw attention to something that you don't want to have attention. You might validate them and elevate them as figures. We have a lot of cognitive science research that suggests that if you try to respond to, correct a lie, you can end up reinforcing it in the minds of the people who hear it. And the whole way that the internet is structured, often algorithms are designed to spread, they respond to engagement. So if I try to fact check or push back on some claim that's made, it can often end up spreading it. We get that if it's some couple people at the end of the bar, or somebody wrote something terrible about you on a men's room wall somewhere. Like, you would never think, I need to do a press conference. But I quote Jory Craig saying, like, because it came from the internet, people's brains were broken. They did not have the ability to realize that, like, is this the equivalent of two people at the end of the bar when you'd obviously ignore it? Is this the equivalent of 100 people are gathering with signs where maybe you need to think about who are those people, whatever? Or is this on the front page of the Kansas City Star? And translating what are intuitive decisions for people in the offline world to the new online world has been really difficult. And that's, I think, what her big success has been, is at least getting people within Democratic campaigns to sort of think in those terms.
The Lie Detectives is largely an exploration about how disinformation is being used against Democrats. What's happening on the other side of the aisle? Are Republicans not also being targeted with disinformation?
I think we can see the summer, you know, plenty of examples. You know, I think there was a spate of claims made after the assassination attempt on President Trump that, in the absence of any evidence, that it was staged or faked or for example, they, you know, I'll say that I don't think that there's been any example of disinformation that has come from the American left that has been as durable or had the reach as some of the sort of totalizing conspiracy theories that have really shaped Republican politics. And, you know, I would point to QAnon, I'd point to COVID and vaccine-related disinformation and the sort of post-2020 election denialism. So I don't think that they're analogous, but by all means, there is stuff that is circulating from and around the American left that is unquestionably qualifies as disinformation and should concern us. But there's another, you know, there's an asymmetry in the information ecosystems on these sides. Whereas if you map out what are the biggest sources of news and information on the left, they are often traditional news organizations that at least aspire to some degree of neutrality and often are susceptible to libel lawsuits and other constraints on what they do. You look at the biggest shares that are coming from the New York Times or NPR, right? If you look on the right, and you map out actually the nodes of communication on many social networks, they are not coming from organizations that consider themselves journalism organizations. And so there's an asymmetry in the information ecosystem. The people I'm writing about are largely playing defense or reacting to things. And the other asymmetry is that people on the right kind of refuse to accept the premise that disinformation is a meaningful category. And, you know, I think that it is one of the remarkable things that sort of right now unites the kind of pre-Trump traditional Republicans and the MAGA world is just basic acceptance of the idea that quote-unquote disinformation was something that was invented by Democrats so that they could get academic researchers to come up with some foundation to pressure the deep state to crack down on tech companies so that they would silence conservative voices. This is a, you know, shared view across the Republican world. And that means that there are a lot of people in Republican politics who closely follow what is said online and try to figure out how to anticipate and respond to it, but they do not think of what they're doing as sort of countering disinformation.
I'm visiting with Sasha Eisenberg. He's the author of The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. We've been talking pretty much exclusively about disinformation in American politics, but this week, Brazil has been in the news as they grapple with disinformation and a big WhatsApp scandal. Coincidentally, you take kind of a deep dive into disinformation in Brazil in your book, The Lie Detectives. Are there lessons we can learn here in the U.S. from what's happening there?
Yeah, so in the recent development has been that the Supreme Electoral Tribunal in Brazil has ordered that X, Twitter, be forbidden from operating within the country, and with significant legal threats and fines for people that for the company to operate and for people who would try to access it through VPN or other means. And it is really the latest in what has been we're now into year five or six of this court, which is kind of a court in name only, trying to aggressively police political disinformation. And this all starts in the aftermath of the 2018 election in Brazil. This is when Jair Bolsonaro gets elected. Much like our 2016 election, the aftermath of his victory is accompanied by this sort of inquest into the digital communication that supported him. And Kay, you refer to this WhatsApp scandal. Basically, in short, it was found out that Bolsonaro supporters were paying to disseminate lies through closed WhatsApp groups. And this became a big criminal investigation. But this court that existed, that's existed since the 1930s, sort of assigned itself responsibility for keeping falsehoods off of the internet. And this, I call it a court because that's technically its title, but this is an institution that has no analog in our country. It's the nation's elections administrator. So they, you know, run the polling places and announce, they count the votes and announce who won. They set rules around things like campaign finance reform. It is a court, but it can't really be appealed. Many of the decisions cannot be appealed to a higher court. It's a court of basically last resort on anything related to elections. And it has an enforcement capacity to issue and enforce criminal and civil penalties for election violations without much accountability at all. And so after 2018, this court started basically cobbling together a lot of authority that existed in various places in Brazilian law, much of it from before the internet existed, to give itself the power to basically not only determine what is true and false as far as electoral communication is concerned, but to take just about any step possible to address that. And it has been incredibly effective at doing that. It has had people jailed. It has issued fines that, as we saw from X, from Twitter, scare multinational companies into doing its bidding, like often, you know, tens of thousands of dollars an hour to Facebook or other companies for posts that the court determines are false. It really has scared both the tech companies and a lot of people in Brazilian politics. And the you will not hear a lot of people who normally would be in Brazil would normally be very concerned about a consolidation of unaccountable power, constitutional law professors, good government activists, civil society types, complaining about this because they've been very pleased with the outcomes, which is that this court probably did more than anyone else in Brazil, including Lula da Silva, who's the president again, who beat Bolsonaro in 2022, from having Bolsonaro win another term. The court, you know, basically kept Bolsonaro and his supporters in a box online. And so the sort of broad center and left of Brazilian politics will not articulate doubts about this court, even though it is illiberal in almost every way you can possibly imagine. And so I wanted to, I spent some time there before the 2022 elections. I want to understand how the court works, and I also want to understand how campaigns navigated a world where everything became a legal fight. And you know, what I came away from as an American and one who, you know, cares about the freedom of expression and a lively public sphere, like, on one hand, it is impressive what it is possible in many ways to police the internet. It's also really scary when it happens. And, you know, I think that when people start to think about what an aggressive enforcement regime would look like, we should look at Brazil, which is both a, you know, a success story and a cautionary tale, I think.
Well, what are the big distinctions between fighting disinformation in Brazil or other countries versus the U.S. is we have the First Amendment.
Yeah.
Does that make fighting disinformation almost impossible?
It makes it very difficult. You know, so the First Amendment gives basically, you know, an absolute right to free speech, to free expression. And to oversimplify a lot of complex constitutional law, it basically means that if you're balancing somebody's free speech rights against almost anything else, you have to give a lot of weight to the free speech rights. In Brazil, there are some guarantees of free expression, but there are lots of other guarantees, and they balance them. And some of those are public safety. Some of those are, you know, Brazil has a very recent history of dictatorship, and there are concerns about propaganda and the way that it was only in the mid-80s that Brazil got rid of its military dictatorship, and there's a real urgent fear that if you allow certain forms of propaganda to circulate, that you will have a return to that type of totalitarianism. And so courts are weighing an individual's right to free expression against all these other public interests. And often the public safety interests or wins out. And that's actually a balancing test that many countries on earth would have a version of. And, you know, I think the First Amendment is wonderful. You and I are in lines of work that benefit from it greatly. But it does mean that any law that Congress were to make, or state legislature for that matter, regulate speech around politics or otherwise is going to, you know, be up against a pretty strong burden in court to justify itself. And that is just a simple fact of how American law and culture work. And, you know, I don't think there's anywhere near the political will, though, in the United States to even go up to that line right now in a way that there was in Brazil because of Brazil's recent history.
Sasha Eisenberg is the author of The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. Our conversation will continue right after this. From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 89.9 Atchison. Support for KPR Presents comes from the KU School of Music, presenting the 25th annual Collage Concert, showcasing student musicians and KU's Marching Jayhawks, Saturday, 7:30 p.m. at the Lead Center. Open to the public. Details at music.ku.edu. And from you. KPR Presents helps keep you entertained, up to date, and informed on the important issues in today's political climate, including disinformation on the campaign trail. Be a part of making KPR Presents happen. Pledge your support today at kansaspublicradio.org. And thanks. Welcome back to KPR Presents. I'm Kay McIntyre. I'm visiting with Sasha Eisenberg. He's the author of Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. Sasha, it occurs to me that for most of us who aren't professionally involved in campaigns or don't have a win-at-all-costs attitude about elections, what we want to know isn't so much a playbook for how to win elections in the disinformation age, but a playbook for holding fair elections and fair campaigns in a disinformation age. Is something lost when we're focusing on winning?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to bite off sort of one part of the conversation about disinformation, and the thing that I felt like hadn't really been explored enough was how politicians, campaign operatives sort of navigate this world. And it is a very slim book that I hope sheds light on sort of their perspective in this. But I think the perspective of citizens, the perspective of policymakers, the perspective of people who are, concerned with the long-term health of our democracy, obviously matter a lot too. I think there's been a lot more conversation, none of it immensely satisfying a lot of the time, but certainly very different considerations, I think, for other people than there are for sort of political actors themselves who are, you know, quite reasonably acting out of their own sort of self-interest.
In The Lie Detectives, you tell a story. It's just kind of a side note, but it's one that really caught my interest. Tell us about the organization Dry Alabama.
So I'll take it. So we're back now in 2017. This is still a period where Democrats are trying to kind of figure out what the new rules for campaigning are. And there was a special election in Alabama that year to this feels like ancient history. It wasn't that long ago. But if you recall, there's a guy named Jeff Sessions who was a senator who gets named to be Donald Trump's first attorney general. His seat opens up. And it's the first major election of the Trump era. And so it becomes sort of this proving ground for Democratic operatives, party organizations, donors, funders to sort of figure out how are we running campaigns in the Trump era. And so people are trying a lot of new things out there. And it's the first place where the kind of toolbox of what do we do with disinformation, you know, gets opened up. And there's some people who are trying to start tracking disinformation and figuring out how to respond to it. But there are also some people in Democratic politics who are saying, well, why aren't we making our own? And there end up being these two separate projects that pop up, one of which, this group Dry Alabama, it starts appearing on Facebook, and to anybody who saw it, you would think this is a group of conservative Protestant temperance activists in Alabama who want to maintain laws limiting the sale and distribution of liquor. Over the course of this special election campaign, this Facebook group starts putting out messages that suggest that Roy Moore, who was the Republican nominee for the Senate seat, that they were supporting him, that he was allied with them. This wasn't a huge reach. Moore came out of a world of sort of fundamentalist politics temperance prohibition activists have a footprint. But this group was totally fabricated, and there was no way to know this if you just happened to see their stuff in your feed. But they were promoting this message that, you know, that neo-prohibitionists and Roy Moore were allied to a sliver of sort of moderate pro-business Republicans who were expected to be voters in the special election, were the type of people who probably were skeptical of Roy Moore to begin with for a bunch of reasons, and also probably like to have a mint julep or bourbon cocktail of their choice. And it was deception. It did not come out. There are a few people who sort of raised questions about it when they saw it in 2017, but nobody really figured out that it had been developed by a progressive activist as part of a sort of sustained effort to deceive people, until a year later, when it and a totally different project that was designed to make it look like a collection of Russian bots were following Roy Moore to give the perception that he was backed by Russian intelligence services. These two separate false flag operations had been hatched and developed by two completely different groups. They had both received money from Reid Hoffman, who was a founder of LinkedIn and a big tech investor, who had become, after 2016, sort of the most important new donor in Democratic politics. And as soon as he put, $100,000 into each of these at a time when he was seeding tons of different initiatives across the left. But when it came back, he was called a hypocrite for having funded these things, because on one hand, he and his top political advisor at the time, Dimitri Melhorn, were talking about how Trump is a threat to, you know, democracy and the rule of law because he lies. And at the same time, they were funding these, you know, deceptive, these disinformation campaigns. And Reid Hoffman comes out and says, I don't want my money going to anything like this again. And what that ended up doing in late 2018 was basically short-circuiting what had been an open conversation in Democratic politics about how, to what extent Democrats should be, as people say, fighting fire with fire. You will still hear Democrats quietly say today, well, if we're on the receiving end of this stuff, why aren't we making it to try to drive votes away from Trump or other MAGA candidates? But when the biggest money bags in Democratic politics came out and said, this crosses a line for me, he ended up writing a line basically everybody in progressive politics at that point either was taking his money or wanted his money. And when he said, I don't want any of my money going to this stuff, it basically drew a moral line around this activity that, as best I can tell, over the last 6 years now, has been respected by organized entities within progressive politics, which is there's not been any sort of sustained effort to perpetuate falsehoods as part of a strategy.
When they go low, we go high.
When they go low, we get afraid of bad press coverage in the Washington Post and react by trying to cover our, I won't go that low, but on public radio. But I think it was a very instinctive reaction to guard against exposure and the blowback that came along with it. And if that had never gotten reported by, in one case, the Washington Post, and the other by the New York Times, I could imagine a world where you'd have major Democratic super PACs right now feeling that with impunity, they could, they should be, doing large-scale advertising campaigns to convince people that, J.D. Vance was born in Uruguay or something.
Sasha, by virtue of this subject in this world of disinformation and murky internet players, talk about some of the challenges you faced as you did the research and reporting for the Lie Detectives.
I mean, there's the same sort of murky information world that the characters I'm facing, right? Which is, I don't really know everything that's out there. I want to write about it with a sense of perspective. Ultimately, what I tried to do was to let the reader see this through the eyes of people as they were often fumbling through the dark for the first time. And I did not want to convey a sort of false sense of omniscience as a journalist writing about it. And so what you see over the course of the book are a lot of different characters coming to this area, the subject, from very different backgrounds, encountering it for the first time in the sort of post-2016 period in American politics. And what I hope I convey is the fact that they had very few assumptions up front about what the problem was, how you address it, how you balance some of these imperatives for what's best for democracy with what's best for my campaign. And that if the reader comes away, nobody knows everything about what's going on online, and I don't want to give the impression that I did, or give the reader the impression, if you read my book, you'll understand the whole landscape either. And it's changing dramatically. And, this is very much a snapshot, I think, of where some of the smartest people who are working on this stuff think things are in 2024, as we are obviously in the midst of another presidential election year, congressional and state elections, and elections around the world, the busiest election year in global history. I think this is a very good account of where those people are now, but I guarantee you in 2 years or 4 years, they will be in a very different place. The technology will be in a very different place. The posture of the platforms that have a lot of say about what moves across them will be in a very different place. Quite possibly the people who are perpetuating deceptions online will be in a different place. And unlike some other books I've written, this one I think will become obsolete much more quickly as a result.
I want to go back to where we started. Back in 2012, you wrote the book, The Victory Lab, and you described it as a fairly optimistic look at what the internet was doing for democracy and political systems. It's 2024. You've just written The Lie Detectives. Has reporting on political misinformation made you hopelessly cynical about elections in this country?
I've had a lot of time to think about the ways in which I was naive. And I don't think I probably was.
We all were.
We all were, yeah. And I think that, and I don't think it's because I, you know, am hopelessly optimistic and only see good in people, although at least one out of those two things I think are true. It was that a lot of incentives were aligned for people, institutions to be mostly focused on, you know, the three core things that any political campaign can do. One is win over, change the opinions of people whose opinions are up for grabs, right? Persuade the voters in the middle, turn out supporters of yours who are not already regularly, you know, are not regular voters, and register people who are likely to support you and are not. Those are the three things that campaigns do. And everything else, raising money, whatever else, is in the service of those. And the logic of that, I think, meant that it never really made sense for a campaign to prioritize driving the other side's opponents from voting, trying to confuse the other side's opponents. Every campaign faces the problem of, we have too many people on our side or persuadable in the middle that we already want to communicate with, and not enough time or money to do it, that the idea that you would devote yourself to disillusioning the other side would just be, not because it's amoral or something, it would just be inefficient. And so I thought there was a very good logic to, and that the systems of accountability that we started talking about, okay, like, are real. Like, politicians, there were so many penalties for a politician or a political professional to be seen as a liar or a cheater, you know, not just because the voters might look ill upon it, but because their donors don't like to be associated with people who are, you know, politicians are thinking about careers and long term, you know, so yeah, I could maybe try to do this to win this election, but if I do, I'm going to go back to the Senate, and other senators aren't going to want to work with me if I'm seen as, you know, somebody who cuts corners or doesn't tell the truth. My donors won't be there. I won't get good committee assignments. I won't be able to build governing coalitions. And yeah, it might help me for this next term, but how do I build a career off of that? And one thing that Donald Trump has done in a way that I think has been transformative is he has changed the way that many people in politics think about the short term and the long term. He never intended to have a long-term career in politics. And as, you know, Maggie Haberman, who's I think the finest chronicler of Donald Trump that we have, you know, likes to say he lives his life in, I forget if she says 10-minute or 15-minute increments, but he does whatever gets him through the next period. And sometimes that's lying, sometimes that's manipulating the system in both small and big ways, but he's never thinking about, okay, well, what will that mean about relationships down the line? And I think that that way of thinking has over the last 8 years, infected a lot of people in politics in this country to say things that they would not have said otherwise, and to feel that, you know, whatever short-term bump they get in press attention or in likes or shares or, you know, fundraising in the next few hours is worth it. Because they're not weighing that against, hey, will this make it harder for me to work with somebody a few years from now? And that has dramatically changed the environment in which we practice politics. And I was certainly naive in thinking that the factors that sort of govern the behavior of political elites would remain the way that they were forever, and that the speed and dynamism of the internet would not affect the sort of way that the political brain worked. And that can be scary. Long-term self-interest among politicians actually turned into a pretty good, healthy force in American life, because it kept people behaving pretty well. They didn't want to be seen as, you know, bad actors in a legislative body or whatever else. Short-term self-interested behavior can be really dangerous. And I think we're in a moment right now where a lot of people who have political power or access to political power are thinking in a far more short-term way about what's best for them. And I am scared about where that will lead.
Sasha, I'm going to ask you to take off your journalist hat for a moment. You and I are both journalists, but we're also consumers of news, as are all of our KPR listeners who are tuning in right now. How can we all be smarter about the way we consume news in the disinformation age.
So I think bring a degree of suspicion to things you encounter, especially, you know, in unfamiliar venues, right? You know your local newspaper, you have a history with it, you know your local radio, public radio station, you have a history with it. You encounter things online that are coming from places you do not have a history with. So be suspicious, the way you would be suspicious if somebody came up to you in the supermarket parking lot and started telling you this is how the world works. Just because something's on a computer screen does not make it any more credible than somebody coming up to you in a supermarket parking lot. Be particularly skeptical if things sound too good to be true. They flatter your existing biases. You hear something, you know, wonderfully terrible about a political figure you already hate, or something it's unbelievably great about somebody you like. Be especially suspicious then, because for all sorts of obvious reasons, you're gonna take to that information, whether or not it's true. If something sounds too good to be true, Google whatever it is in the words fact check and hope that a credible news organization has looked into it. There are all sorts of limitations and some problems with the sort of fact checking apparatus, but one of the things that's happened over the last few years is news organizations have invested in trying to chase down rumors and claims and look for something from the Associated Press or Snopes or NPR or the Washington Post or something that at least you know that somebody looked into this and tried to adjudicate it. It'll never be fast enough to respond to the velocity of stuff online. But it's a good place to start. And while you're doing all that, there's hardly anything that you need to share online right away. And so if something sounds too good to be true, pull back from the share or retweet button. Do a quick Google. Like, I don't think anybody can be reasonably expected, if you read some claim about, you know, what Tim Walz's approach to sales taxes when he was, you know, governor, to read all the whole literature on tax history in Minnesota. But probably a 20-second Google on a major national issue will get you some clarity as to whether this is totally bogus. If you hold back from sharing the original thing, you Google it and you find a fact check that says, no, this is a lie, or this is lacking some necessary context, share the fact check. One of the problems with the way that the internet, social media tends to work is people share the exciting stuff, which probably over-indexes for lies and falsehood. And when you get the boring correction, nobody wants to share that. I think one way to be a good online citizen is, you know, to oversimplify, the bad guys have very well-developed networks where they're pushing out bad information. The good guys, you know, good citizens, news consumers, should use the networks you have built, your friends, your family members, your bowling league, whoever you're connected to on Facebook. And if you get a fact check because you encounter something in the wild and you've learned it's not true, push the fact check out so that that is reaching the people in your network and also helping just to amplify it with those algorithms. That's the biggest practical advice I can have. I would just also try to encourage people to kind of internalize what we were talking about earlier about the sort of what the offline analog of this would be, and think about how you would respond if one crazy person on a street corner was yelling something. You'd probably shrug it off and walk by. Maybe you'd go home and tell your spouse, oh, I heard a crazy thing on the street corner today. But you wouldn't immediately go and, like, walk up to every door in your neighborhood and knock on it and repeat it. Think about the internet the same way.
Sasha Eisenberg is the author of The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. Sasha, can I have you close with an excerpt?
Sure. So this is the beginning of a chapter that is called Eat the Babies. And you will not find out in this excerpt what that means. But shortly after voting to pass a bill to protect student loan borrowers from damage to their credit scores, 16 Democratic members of Congress headed three blocks south of the Capitol and ducked out of the frigid winter night into a borrowed townhouse where a fireplace smoldered as a chef toiled in the kitchen. None of those who had received an invitation knew quite what to expect from the evening. I've convened this dinner tonight because I think we all know disinformation is not going away, Illinois Representative Sherry Bustos told them. Bustos was a popular figure among her peers. She had first been elected to Congress in 2012 from an agricultural and industrial district that hugs the Mississippi River. And after a 2016 landslide re-election, the same year her constituents voted for Donald Trump, Bustos became a model of how Democrats could compete in adverse environments. Before the 2018 election, she was appointed to head the Democratic Congressional Campaigns Committee's Heartland Engagement efforts in rural Republican-held districts. After helping her party take back the House that year, Bustos was elected by the new majority to lead the campaign committee through an election cycle when it would have to defend 44 so-called frontline incumbents likely to face serious challenges. She decided to hold a monthly midweek dinner series to tell her fellow House Democrats what her priorities were, devoting the first to disinformation. "I hope you will all quickly just talk about why you are here tonight," she directed her guests once they had taken seats around a long table. There was Susan DelBene, a former Microsoft executive who made technology policy one of her top legislative priorities. There were members of the House Intelligence Committee, which, as part of its investigation into quote-unquote Russian active measures, had released a full list of accounts identified by Twitter as part of suspected bot networks run by the Internet Research Agency, and an archive of 3,500 different Facebook advertisements purchased by the agency, along with all the targeting data demonstrating how clearly the goal was to divide Americans on existing racial, ethnic, gender, and political lines. Then there were others, like Debbie Mukersal-Powell, who had come to this issue purely as a matter of self-preservation. Mukersal-Powell had begun to detect a swirl of Spanish-language disinformation moving through her Miami district, jumping from local talk radio stations to paid newspaper inserts to private WhatsApp groups. Over a two-hour conversation, some of the attendees found themselves on the verge of tears as they recalled receiving threats so credible they had begun to retain private security to protect themselves, their spouses, and their children. Also at the table that night were two young committee staffers previously unknown to most of the elected representatives. Bustos introduced them as leaders of her new disinformation task force, who could speak in greater technical detail about their work, a gentle way of distinguishing the clear emotional suffering that disinformation caused from its potential electoral harm. "I took every single one of those seriously, and then I let our experts figure out exactly what we needed to do," Bustos told me. "Is this a serious disinformation effort against this member or against this campaign? Or is it something where we could just maybe smooth some feelings?"
That's Sasha Eisenberg reading from his new book, The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. Sasha, thank you so much for coming in today.
It's always great to talk to you. Thank you.
I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas. Kansas Public Radio has a copy of The Lie Detectives to give away. For your chance to win a copy, go to kansaspublicradio.org, click on Extras, and then Giveaways. While you're there, consider making a pledge to Kansas Public Radio to support KPR Presents. Again, that's kansaspublicradio.org, and thanks.
Support for KPR Presents comes from The Lead Center, welcoming renowned pianist Jonathan Biss, performing works by Franz Schubert and more. Sunday, September 22nd, 2 p.m. Tickets are available at lead.ku.edu. And the KU School of Music presenting the 25th Annual Collage Concert, showcasing student musicians in KU's Marching Jayhawks, Saturday, 7:30 p.m. at the Lead Center, open to the public. Details at music.ku.edu. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. Online at kansaspublicradio.org.
He's back.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
That's right. Michael Keaton is back with the wild hair and the stripy suit. Director Tim Burton could hardly believe his eyes.
So he shows up on set. It was like demon possession.
The juice is loose.
I'm Ari Shapiro. More with Tim Burton on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 79 and fair. Wind is from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid 80s. Wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. It's 79 and fair. Stay tuned for more KPR weather for Northeast Kansas.
You're listening to the Retro Cocktail Hour.
If you have fun, come home with me. You can stay all night and play with my TV. TV is the thing this year, this year. TV is the thing this year. Radio was great, now it's out of date. TV is the thing this year. Last night I was watching Old Tom Mix. My TV broke, I was in a fix. I got on the phone, called my man, said, get here, Daddy, as fast as you can. TV is the thing this year. Oh, TV is the thing this year. Radio was great, but now it's out of date. And TV is the thing this year. Now he turned my dial to channel one. I knew that this was gonna be fun. He turned my dial to channel two. That station thrilled me through and through. He moved one notch to channel three. I said, how I love what you're doing to me. He said, wait a minute, let's try channel four. Just about the time someone knocked on the door. TV is the thing this year. Oh yes, TV is the thing this year. Radio was great, but now it's out of date. TV is the thing this year. The way he eased into channel five, that man must have had fluid drive. He moved once more to channel six, then he opened up his bag of tricks. On channel seven, the show was late, but we got our kicks. On channel eight, he turned my dial to channel nine, said, baby, your set is fine. He moved on up to channel 10. Then we started all over again. He finally hit channel 11. I cried, mama, he treats your daughter good. TV is the thing this year. Yes, radio was great, but now it's out of date. TV is the thing this year. Baby, my TV set will need fixing just about this time every night.
I don't know. Something tells me they're doing more than watching TV. That's Dinah Washington from 1953. TV is the thing. Right here for you to start this round of the Retro Cocktail Hour. And this week, TV is the thing, because I'm here with another of our TV-themed spectaculars. I'm Daryl Brogdon here at the Underground Martini Bunker, where we're ready to tune in and turn on some of the coolest music from TV's golden age. We've got spies and private eyes, cowboys and cartoon characters, spaceships and sitcoms, and lots more. Plus, we'll count down the 10 most popular TV themes of all time, as voted by members of the Retro Cocktail Hour Facebook group. Time to thaw out a TV dinner and join us for the Retro Cocktail Hour on KPR.
Thank you.
That's Nelson Riddle and his orchestra, the theme from TV's Route 66, here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. This was the show about two guys traveling the country in a Corvette convertible. Nelson Riddle was hired to write a theme when the producers didn't want to pay royalties to Bobby Troup for his famous Route 66 song. Riddle's tune was one of the first TV themes to crack Billboard's top 30 in 1962. This is the Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Darryl Brogdon, on the air again from the Underground Martini Bunker with an entire show devoted to TV themes. I should mention right here that we'll undoubtedly miss a familiar theme here and there. There's just not enough time to hit them all, but we'll do our best. I said before, we're counting down the 10 most popular TV themes, and let's start that right now. These were voted on by members of the Retro Cocktail Hour Facebook group, a totally unscientific survey to be sure, but what can you do? Voted as the 10th most popular TV theme is the Star Trek theme by Alexander Courage. Here it is, featuring the seldom heard lyrics by Gene Roddenberry and played by Project Pimento on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. the Warner Brothers Orchestra, led by Carl Brandt, and the theme music for The Patty Duke Show here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. It was composed by Sid Raymond and Bob Wells. Before that, another legendary sitcom, The Dick Van Dyke Show, with theme music by Earl Hagen, who wrote music for a lot of TV shows in the 1960s, including I Spy, The Mod Squad, and The Andy Griffith Show. Welcome to the Retro Cocktail Hour, where the music is always shaken, not stirred. This week, it's TV on radio, as we sample some of the great, great TV themes of the past. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and you'll find the show online at retrococktail.org. Okay, so next, we have a two-way tie for number 9 in our countdown of the 10 most popular TV themes. Again, these were voted on by members of our Facebook group. First up, it's one of the most memorable TV themes ever, Vic Mizzi's theme music for The Addams Family. Now, on the show, Vic sings the lyrics himself, overdubbed several times, but on the show's official soundtrack album, for some reason, he just does it as an instrumental. Here's that version, The Addams Family, on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio.
Faces that you find. 50-year-old woman. Million in this bombing.
Tied for the number 9 spot in our TV theme countdown, Johnny Rivers, Secret Agent Man, from the British TV show with that name, here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. That song was a big hit, reaching number 3 on the Billboard chart. It's interesting that in Britain, the show was known as Danger Man. And when it came to the U.S., it was retitled Secret Agent, and CBS hired songwriters P.F. Sloan and Steve Barry to write a new theme song for the American broadcast. Thank you kindly for joining us here at the Underground Martini Bunker for another Retro Cocktail Hour. This week, TV is the thing. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and up ahead, two themes for two different shows starring James Garner. But let's continue with our top 10 countdown of the most popular TV themes ever. Next, we have another tie, a three-way tie for the number 8 spot, and we'll start off with the Warner Brothers Orchestra led by Warren Barker for 77 Sunset Strip on the Retro Cocktail Hour from KPR. the second of three tunes tied for number 8 in our TV tune countdown. That's the theme from I Dream of Jeannie, here in the Retro Cocktail Hour. That wasn't the show's theme when it began in 1965. It was only in the second season that the tune by Hugo Montenegro came to be used as the show's official theme song. Okay, we'll hear the third of three at number 8 in just a minute. And later this hour, on the signpost up ahead, it's the Twilight Zone. Now here's the third TV theme tied for the 8 spot in our countdown. This was composed by Jerry Goldsmith for a show about counter-espionage and secret agents who worked for a law enforcement agency known as UNCLE, the United Network Command for Law Enforcement. The man from UNCLE used different composers almost every season. Guys like Nelson Riddle, Lalo Schifrin, Robert Drasnan, and Richard Shores. Here's the theme music by Jerry Goldsmith, played by guitarist Al Caiola, on the album Sounds for Spies and Private Eyes, and on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio.
On the Retro Cocktail Hour, a production of Kansas Public Radio.
Support for the Retro Cocktail Hour on KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center of JCCC, presenting Leonardo, a wonderful show about a terrible monster. Friday evening, puppets and songs bring Mo Willems books to life. Details at jccc.edu/mtc.
That little train that is rolling down the tracks to the junction. Forget about your cares, it is time to relax at the junction. Lots of curves, you bet, and even more when you get to the junction, Petticoat Junction. Well, there's a little hotel called a Shady Ranch at the junction. It is run by Kate, come and be her guest at the junction.
And you'll meet Uncle Joe. He's a moving kind of slow at the junction, Petticoat Junction. When they hear the dinner bell from the Shady Rest Hotel at the junction, folks will walk a country mile for that chicken country style at the junction. But the dishes to observe are those pretty gals who serve at the junction. Well, we'll soon be leaving town. There's old Charlie oiling round. Can she make it up the hill that leads to Hooterville? The pressure's on the rise, Floyd is burning railroad ties. Everybody get inside, doesn't cause a cent to ride. Come one and come all and we'll take that cannonball to the junction, Petticoat Junction.
That's Brian Fahey and his orchestra, the theme music for The Saint, here on the Retro Cocktail Hour, composed by Edwin Astley for the Roger Moore series in the 1960s. Before that, Maverick, the opening tune for the TV Western of the late 50s. We heard Marty Gold and his orchestra from a great album called Swingin' West, featuring big band versions of TV Western themes. James Garner was the star of this one as gambler Brett Maverick. The show ran till 1962. Also in that set, Petticoat Junction, sung by Kurt Massey, who was a familiar voice during the golden age of radio. The song, of course, is from the show about the Shady Rest Hotel, run by Kate Bradley and Uncle Joe. The song was written by Kurt Massey and by Paul Henning, who created the show. It's all TV tunes this week on the Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and there's lots more to come, including themes from Leave It to Beaver and Burke's Law. To find our show on the web, it's retrococktail.org. Well, all right, here's number 7 in our TV theme countdown, voted on by members of the Retro Cocktail Hour Facebook group. It's the theme music by Mike Post and Pete Carpenter for The Rockford Files, which was on TV from 1974 to 1980. This got to number 10 on the Billboard charts for 2 weeks in 1975. Here's Johnny Gregory and his orchestra on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio.
More fascinating than dreams, a place where the past mingles with the present in the mysterious region of time. This is Rod Serling inviting you to leave reality for an exciting excursion into the unknown each week on the new hour-long Twilight Zone.
Marty Manning and his orchestra with the theme music from The Twilight Zone here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. It's from the album of that name, which is a classic of space-age pop featuring guitarist Mondell Lowe, vocalist Lois Hunt, and percussionist Phil Krause, among others. You know, when The Twilight Zone first came on the air, it used a theme composed by Bernard Herrmann, but by season two, this was replaced with a tune by the French avant-garde composer Marius Constant. In fact, it's two different tunes by Constant, which were edited together by CBS music director Lud Gluskin. For the record, the tunes are called Étrange No. 3 for electric guitar and Milieu No. 2, a feature for guitar, bongos, brass, and flutes. I can't believe this one didn't crack our top 10. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and this is the Retro Cocktail Hour. This week, we're hearing some classic TV tunes. Still to come, music for private eyes and UFOs. Our show's on public radio stations every week at this time, and you can hear it on demand anytime at retrococktail.org. There's one I bet we all remember, even if you didn't watch the TV show. It's the Leave It to Beaver theme on the Retro Cocktail Hour, composed by Dave Kahn. The tune's original title is The Toy Parade, and it has lyrics by Mort Green, and I only know of one recording of the version with lyrics, which was done for a children's record in 1958, around the time the TV show began. We just heard the theme played by Richard Gleason and his orchestra. You're with me, Daryl Brogdon, for the Retro Cocktail Hour. This week, it's all TV tunes. Up ahead, we'll hear the theme for Burke's Law and another in our countdown of the 10 most popular TV themes. Next up is a theme that's maybe not as familiar as Leave It to Beaver. That's because the show for which it was created was on TV for less than a year. It was a show called The DA's Man, produced by Jack Webb and featuring this music by Frank Comstock, with Paul Tanner at the Electro Theremin on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. Thank you. That's music by Herschel Burke Gilbert for Burke's Law, that terrific 60s show by the captain of the L.A. Homicide Division, who also just happens to be a millionaire. Because, you know, that's the kind of thing that happens all the time. Before that, on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Barry Gray with a UFO theme. This was a British show about a secret government organization that defends the Earth against extraterrestrial invaders. And it seems like there were an awful lot of aliens that wanted to invade us. Like every week, you dig? Thanks for joining us here at the Underground Martini Bunker for another Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon. We inhabit this space every week at this time on public radio stations worldwide. Find out more at retrococktail.org. All right, we're going to wind up this hour with the theme that came in at number 6, voted on by members of the Retro Cocktail Hour Facebook group. I'm sure you'll recognize it. It's composed by Lalo Schifrin, and it's here for you on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. Okay, so that's the theme music for Mannix, the Private Eye show starring Mike Connors and Gail Fisher. Here for you on the Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon. You're with me here at the Retro Cocktail Hour, serving up space-age pop and incredibly strange music, and occasionally TV themes from here at the Underground Martini Bunker. From the University of Kansas, it's Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City, 91.3. And KANQ Chanute, 90.3. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Stress. We all get it. We all wish it would go away. Fortunately, there is a solution. The Retro Cocktail Hour. When you suit up in a Retro Cocktail Hour t-shirt or sip a Mai Tai in one of our official 25th anniversary tiki mugs, you'll feel the stress melt away. To stock up on all our latest merchandise, just go to retrococktail.org and click on Store.
You're listening to the Retro Cocktail Hour.
Take that, evildoers. That's the theme song for TV's Wonder Woman, starting off this round of the Retro Cocktail Hour. The music is by Charles Fox and lyrics by Norman Gimbel, certainly one of the most memorable themes of the 1970s. Welcome to the Retro Cocktail Hour, where the music's always served up shaken, not stirred. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and in this hour, we continue our TV theme spectacular, including shows like The Green Hornet, Dragnet, The Simpsons, and The Andy Griffith Show. Plus, we will continue our countdown of the 10 most popular TV themes of all time, as voted by members of the Retro Cocktail Hour Facebook group. And we've still got 5 more to go. My mother always told me TV would rot my brain. Clearly, she was right. And that's why we have the Retro Cocktail Hour on Kansas Public Radio. That's Hoyt Curtin's sensational theme for Johnny Quest. The original series was just one season in the mid-60s, but the character has lived on in new shows, comic books, and computer games. And rumor has it there's a feature film in the works, too. And that tune was voted number 5 by the Retro Cocktail Hour Facebook group in the 10 greatest TV themes of all time. Ahead of that, on the Retro Cocktail Hour, the theme music for Perry Mason, composed by Fred Steiner and played here by Ralph Martiri and his orchestra. It's from the album Music for a Private Eye. Thanks for joining us for another Retro Cocktail Hour. This week, we're all about TV. Still to come, some TV themes that also crossed over and became pop hits. Speaking of which, here's a tune that's become a sort of standard, I guess, even though the show for which it was created only lasted one season. It's about time we heard from Henry Mancini, and here's his theme music from Mr. Lucky on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you. star-spangled night, my love.
My love, come to me.
You can rest your head on my shoulder while by the dawn's early light, my love. I will defend your right to try. Our love meet the same old moon.
Meet the same old moon.
But it shines red, white, and blue now. And in this land of hopes and dreams, my love, all that I hope for tis of thee.
Your spell, bewitched, bewitched, you know your craft so well. Before I knew what you were doing, I looked in your eyes. That brand of woo that you've been brewing took me by surprise. You witch, you witch, one thing is for sure, that stuff that you pitch just hasn't got a cure. My heart was under lock and key, but somehow it got unhitched. I never thought my heart could be had, but now I'm caught and I'm kinda glad to be. My heart was under lock and key, but somehow it got unhitched. I never thought my heart could be had, but now I'm caught and I'm kinda glad that you do that crazy.
Steve Lawrence and Bewitched from the TV show of that name here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. The song was written by Howard Greenfield and Jack Keller, and the lyrics we just heard weren't used on the show. Jack Keller has said that at one time they planned to use the vocal version of the theme, but the producers didn't want to pay $2,500 to hire a vocalist. Also in that set, Love American Style, composed by Charles Fox. For the first season, the theme was sung by the Cowsills, but a new version was used thereafter featuring the Ron Hicklin Singers. Before that, Al Hurt and his orchestra from The Horn Meets the Hornet and the unforgettable theme from The Green Hornet. The show was kind of a bust, but that music is out of sight. This is the Retro Cocktail Hour, the home of space-age pop and incredibly strange music. I'm Daryl Brogdon, on the air from the underground martini bunker, with America's Stone Age family coming up. But now it's time to unveil the fourth most popular TV theme in our Retro Cocktail Hour, Hall of Fame. This tune was written by Laurie Johnson and was originally called The Shake when it appeared on an album in 1965 called The Big New Sound Strikes Again. We know it better today as the theme from The Avengers on the Retro Cocktail Hour from KPR.
Thank you. is our little dinosaur. He's good, but nobody knows what for.
When you meet the Flintstones, have a
yabba-dabba-doo time. A dabba-doo time.
You'll have a gay old time.
Fred's bosom buddy friend.
As long as he has a buck to lend.
When you're with the Rubbles, have a
scoop-a-doop-a-doop time. A doop-a-doop time.
You'll have a gay old time.
Well, one of the best known of all TV themes, Meet the Flintstones, here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Now, the version we just heard is not the same as that used on the show. I wanted to play this one because it features the four original cast members. Alan Reed is Fred, Gene Vanderpil is Wilma, Mel Blanc is Barney, and Bea Benaderet is Betty. Am I the only one here who thinks that Betty Rubble was like the hottest woman on 60s TV? You know, Meet the Flintstones wasn't the original theme for that show. They used another tune by Hoyt Curtin entitled Rise and Shine during the show's first two seasons. Before that, Neil Hefti's famous theme for The Odd Couple, done here by the Billy May Orchestra. Glad you made it in for another Retro Cocktail Hour coming at you in all three dimensions from here at the Underground Martini Bunker. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and we're yet to reveal the top three TV tunes in our countdown. That's ahead in the next 30 minutes. Hey, you know the name of the first TV soundtrack album? It's believed to be the soundtrack for the TV show Danger, which was on in the early 1950s. Music for the show was created by guitarist Tony Mottola and the Ray Charles Singers. Here's the theme music on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. Thank you.
the Retro Cocktail Hour. Would somebody please adjust my stereo? A production of Kansas Public Radio.
Support for the Retro Cocktail Hour on KPR comes from Green Lady Lounge, offering live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Green Lady Lounge is located at 1809 Grand Boulevard, Kansas City. Information at greenladylounge.com. And the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu. I'm pretty sure you don't need me to tell you the name of that tune. It's Dragnet, Peter Appleyard and his orchestra, theme music by Walter Schumann, and a tune that was the subject of a lawsuit brought by composer Miklos Rocha, who claimed the famous Dragnet four-note motif was lifted from music he wrote for the movie The Killers in 1946. And after listening to Rocha's music for that film, I kind of think he was right. You're with me, Daryl Brogdon, at the Underground Martini Bunker for the Retro Cocktail Hour. This week, TV is the thing. We'll wrap up our top 10 countdown in this half hour and hear lots more tunes for the tube. Right now, it's the theme that finished at number 3 in the voting. Henry Mancini wrote his Peter Gunn theme for for the TV show of that name in 1958. The story goes that Mancini at first wasn't convinced that anyone would buy a soundtrack album from Peter Gunn, and it was actually Ray Anthony who had the first hit record with the tune in 1959. Henry Mancini, the Peter Gunn theme, at number 3 on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Neil Hefti's Batman theme from the sixth of the Retro Cocktail Hour. Hefti was a guy who made his bones as an arranger composer in the big band era, and then he worked a lot with the Count Basie band in the 50s, and by the 60s was writing considerable music for TV and movies. The Batman theme is a pretty simple tune, basically a 12-bar blues progression with a sound that mixes surf and spy music. Ahead of that, guitarist Vinnie Bell in a tune called Nikki, which was written by Burt Bacharach, and throughout the early 1970s was used as the theme music for the ABC Movie of the Week. Thanks so much for joining us here at the Underground Martini Bunker for another Retro Cocktail Hour. This week it's all about TV tunes, and there's more to come, including the theme that was voted number one by members of our Facebook group. We're on public radio stations every week at this time, and you can listen on demand anytime at retrococktail.org. That's probably the only theme you'll hear tonight that's still running. Danny Elfman and the theme music for The Simpsons. Here on the Retro Cocktail Hour's TV Themes Countdown. It's from the album Music for a Darkened Theater. Well, okay, it's time to reveal the second most popular TV theme in our countdown. If it was up to me, this would be number one. But like you, I only got one vote. It's Lalo Schifrin's theme music from Mission Impossible, a tune I consider the greatest ever written for a TV show. This came out in 1967. It got to number 7 on the Billboard chart. It's written in 5/4 time, which Lalo Schifrin says is for people who have 5 legs. It's been covered I don't know how many times. Somebody once said that if you're unfamiliar with this tune, it's because A, you're under 5 years of age, B, you've been living with a Unabomber for the last 25 years, or C, you're unaware of television. Number 2 with the Bullets, Lalo Schifrin and the Mission Impossible theme, on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio.
It's your girl and you should know it. With each glance and every little movement you show it. Love is all around, no need to waste it. You can have it down, why don't you take it? You're gonna make it after all. You're the one most likely to succeed.
That is one terrific TV tune. John Williams and the theme from Checkmate. You're in the Retro Cocktail Hour. This was a show from the early 60s created by writer Eric Ambler and all about a team of detectives whose mission is to prevent crime before it happens. Before that, Earl Hagen's legendary theme for the Andy Griffith Show. There's another one I can't believe didn't make it to the top 10. A lot of people thought it was Andy Griffith whistling the theme, but in fact, it's composer Earl Hagen, who said he wrote the tune in all of 15 minutes. Also, one of the most iconic TV themes of the 70s, Love Is All Around, a song written by Sonny Curtis, who sang it every week on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Weird and done here by the Ray Conniff Singers. Glad you're here for the Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and we're rocking the Underground Martini Bunker every week on public radio stations. Listen on demand at retrococktail.org. We're also on Facebook. You can follow me in the Twitterverse at KPR Brogdon. And if you want to reach out, my email is host@retrococktail.org. Thanks so much for joining us for our TV themes countdown. And even though we don't have a drum roll, here is the tune voted the most popular TV theme ever by members of the Retro Cocktail Hour Facebook group. Morton Stevens wrote it for a show that came along in 1968 about an elite police task force based in Hawaii. And here's a factoid. Did you know that it's illegal in British Columbia to play this tune at a cannabis dispensary? It's true. They're afraid it'll tip off the presence of their undercover inspectors. So, apologies if you're hearing this in British Columbia, but here's number one, the Hawaii Five-O theme by Morton Stevens on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News and the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City, 91.3, and KANQ Chanute, 90.3. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org. And listen anytime for the Retro Cocktail Hour at retrococktail.org. Support for the Retro Cocktail Hour on KPR comes from KU School of Music, presenting the 25th Annual Collage Concert, showcasing student musicians and KU's Marching Jayhawks. Saturday, 7:30 p.m. at the Lead Center, open to the public. Details at music.ku.edu.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. Any good news organization should bring you points of view that you agree with and points of view that you don't. Facts you approve. and facts that make you uncomfortable. Our job is to bring you the full picture in context so you can decide. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Lopez. Now here's your weather forecast for the KPR listening area. It's 73 and partly cloudy. Wind is from the south-southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight clear with a low in the low 50s. Wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then tomorrow clear with a high in the mid-80s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the mid-50s. It's 73 and partly cloudy. Stay tuned for more KPR weather.
Welcome to Green Lady Lounge, located at 1809 Grand Boulevard in downtown Kansas City. I'm Daryl Brogdon. The Green Lady is the home of Kansas City Jazz, featuring live performances 365 days a year. On this day, we'll be hearing from one of Kansas City's finest guitarists, Danny Embry. He's joined today by bassist Gerald Spates and drummer Brian Stever. It's the Danny Embry Trio, live at the Green Lady Lounge.